So I wanted to congratulate you on the success Paradise Has Lost has had, you know, over the years. It's been quite a while now. So being that Paradise Lost has been such a huge part of your life, how do you identify with that? I mean, how do you separate Gregor McIntosh from Paradise Lost? You know, we found that, you know, the Metallica guys have struggled kind of separating themselves from the beast of Metallica, right? So how do you deal with such things?
Well, the Metallica thing's obvious because, I mean, they lost touch with reality many years ago, you know. For obvious reasons, I guess. It's just, I don't know, we've always been just a bunch of mates just doing it. So, and we don't take it all too seriously. We take the music seriously, but everything else is kind of, you know, we don't really believe anything till we see it sort of thing, you know.
Right.
And growing up in the music business from the age of 18 or whatever, you get to realise very fast that it's not all it seems and you become quite cynical towards it. But then after a while, you just accept it and, I don't know, we just get on with it. We do our own thing and we take it like record by record and just see what happens. There's no huge master plan, you know, so I don't have any trouble separating it, really. I just leave my bag by the door and when I get a call to go somewhere, I go there, you know.
Awesome, yeah, I think it's a good philosophy to have, definitely well-grounded, you know. So speaking of, this kind of is touching around the same thing, but around the time Draconian Times came out, it seemed like you guys had this huge buzz, and it could be because I was reading all these UK magazines, and they were really pushing, the press was really pushing you guys back then in a different way, you know, that kind of towards that Metallica way, the next Metallica and these things and Typo Negative and all the, you know, all this nonsense. So do you feel like, so what's the difference now? What's the difference in climate now for Paradise Lost than it is today as far as all that goes in the environment of metal media and just, I guess, the metal world in general?
Well, it's changed a lot. I mean, the music business has changed. The way the media is has changed. The outlets for media have completely changed with the advent of the internet and stuff like that. Back in 95 or whatever, it was, you know, you were reliant upon a handful of radio, TV and magazines in each country. And it was potluck whether you were going to be chosen and to be pushed by them, I guess. And I guess Draconian Times was just the right album at the right time. You know, if it had been released 3 years later, 3 years earlier, it might have been a different story, I don't know. These days, there's so many media outlets and blogs and everything, it's you know, it's kind of easier to get your name across, but because of that, there's so much out there.
Right.
That you have to sift through so much bullshit to find anything good anymore, so... I think we just kind of go with the flow. There's certain things I like about the modern music scene, and there's certain things I like about the old music scene. I think if I had to pick, I would say I would go back to the old music scene because it just seemed more honest in a way. It seems like there's a hell of a lot of rubbish spoken these days, and right. a lot of backslapping goes on, you know. I mean, we turn up at festivals and it's just a bunch of bands trying to be in a scene together, and I find that really gay, for want of a better word.
Okay.
You know, I can't remember who it was that said it, but maybe we're just too miserable. We got known as the band who backstage at festivals just stands around in the corner talking to each other.
Right.
And that's just because, I don't know, I guess a lot of musicians are dicks.
Yeah, know? No, it's true. You know, it's a lot of...
I'm not even sure I answered your question there.
No, you did. I think you did. Some of those things are obvious, obviously, with the internet and all that, but to have someone like you who has done all that and been on TV programming back then and kind of this big, you know, media pushes, it's very different today. So I just wanted to kind of get your take on that. I actually... reached out to a few friends who are big fans to kind of see what they would ask you. So let me look at one of theirs. So why do you think the UK has always been willing to kind of slow it down and look more inward than other regions of the metal world. You know, I guess with My Dying Bride, you guys, kind of a lot of things that had come out from the UK is kind of more of that somber, even Sabbath, I guess, right? Kind of a slower, heavier pace.
I guess it all started a long time ago with that. And it's all from a specific region of the UK, really. It's the north of the UK, of England. And I have no idea why it all came out like that. There was also a thrash scene at the time, but that never got noticed because, well, the bands are pretty crap, really. But, you know, the slower stuff, all the bands that came out, I mean, yeah, it was all a similar time period and stuff like that. And a similar area, and I've no idea why it is they came out of the UK, but I guess the UK scene got noticed more than any of the other ones at the time, because I know that some bands were coming out in Finland and things like that shortly afterwards, which didn't get as much recognition. So again, I think it's just pot luck, really. You know, you just kind of get picked up on. I remember when we did our demo, it just got instantly picked up on, and like, you know, what is this stuff? You know, we haven't heard death metal this slow before and stuff like that. There was no planning went into it. You know, maybe it was because our drummer wasn't good enough to play fast.
That's funny, because speaking of drummers, I have something to bring up with that later too. But well, that's good. So kind of continuing along this path, some of the music that's come out that has been influenced by Paradise Lost, so kind of the Catatonias of the world and November Dooms and bands of that nature. I remember reading an interview in Terrorizer quite a long time ago, you saying that you loved Brave Murder Day, and you kind of loved hearing your influences come out in that music, but still doing it their own way. What do you think of the evolution of that band and bands of the like that, you know, used you as a giant influence?
Well, there's bands like that, you know, that went on to do more proggy type stuff, which I'm not a fan of, actually. But I'm glad that they went and did their own thing, which is very important for any band. But there's many bands that have been influenced by us that went on to do way better than us, and that's good too. That just shows that, I don't know, maybe they're... I think they're probably better at selling themselves than us. We were never very good salesmen. you know, we kind of got into it just to play a bit of music and do something on a Saturday before we went to the pub or something. you know, so, you know, when it came to doing photo shoots and videos and things, we were highly unprepared, and we still are. So, you know, I think it's great to be... I mean, we used to wear our influences on our sleeve when we first started, and I think it's inevitable that when you start a band that this kind of thing will happen. But if you have any type of career, which is kind of unlikely these days, then you have to move on and try other things and bring in other influences. And most of those bands that were influenced by us that you mentioned, they went on to do completely different things.
And I guess to finish off that question, what are the bands that you are digging today that kind of followed a similar path or that had that influence from Paradise Lost?
Who were influenced by us? That's hard to say, really. There's a lot of bands that come up to me and say they were influenced, but I can't actually hear it in their music. But you never know. I don't know. I mean, I suppose even stuff like Him, you know, I mean, I remember when we played in Helsinki in Finland many, many years ago, a young Villa Valo brought his CD to us and said, can you give this a listen, you know?
Right.
And no one had heard him at the time. He said he was a big fan. So, but I personally can't hear much of us in them anymore, but they went on to do much better. I don't know. I tend to try to listen to bands that have been obviously influenced by us, because it just, I don't know, it's like listening to Down when you can listen to Sabbath, you know?
Right, no, that makes sense, Yeah, I just didn't know if there was any, and I didn't mean it to come off the wrong way, but I just didn't know if there was any that had really sparked your interest, like, wow, man, you know, they really did an awesome job, you know, they kind of took what we were doing and took a spin on it, and I really what they're doing.
I mean, there's a few bands that I can't necessarily hear the influence too much, but... have really told me that we've been a bit like we toured recently with Paul Bearer. Well, I was in Valenfire at the time, another band, but
right.
We toured with Paul Bearer, and they said they were huge fans and they'd been influenced. And to a certain degree, I can hear little bits and pieces, but I think they've done a real interesting thing with the sound, you know.
No, for sure, for sure. Cool. And speaking of Valenfire, I know this isn't a Valenfire interview, but that made my top five this past year of best albums.
Oh, cool.
I think it was unbelievable, and I think Kurt did an amazing job at capturing kind of a very organic, visceral feel on that the newest record. So cheers to that as well.
Oh, nice one. Thanks.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Okay, so kind of going through the discography, like you said, a band evolves, a band changes, and obviously Paradise Lost is kind of made its own way, right? So The Plague Within, seen a lot of praise lately. I love the record, of course. But what has kind of brought it back to full circle? Is this another kind of organic thing? You guys kind of just go with what you're feeling, and it's kind of brought you back to almost to where you started, you know, kind of just bringing it back, stripped down to kind of the old days, musically speaking.
Yeah, I mean... We've been asked this question in a different way a couple of times, where it seems on the surface of it, because I've done Valenfire and Nick was asked to do vocals for Bloodbath, that might have had a huge bearing on this, but believe it or not, it didn't really. You know, Valenfire started in 2010, so there was ample time to incorporate that before now, but the time didn't feel right. It just didn't feel right to do that. And If anything, I think the only thing that those two projects had on Paris Lost was it may have given Nick a bit more confidence in approaching these vocals, this vocal style again. But yeah, the full circle thing, I think it's more to do with when I came to write this record, I just said that I wanted to be able to touch on any era of the band. And at first, a couple of the guys were not too sure about that, thinking that I just wanted to write a full-on death metal album. But when I sort of showed them what my plan was, to kind of, you know, incorporate all eras of the band, have no direction in mind specifically, but just try out different things, they came round to the idea. And this album could have ended up very, very different because we tried out so many different things. But it just happened that this sort of amalgamation of sounds from throughout our career just blended really well, and it just felt the right time to approach it right now, you know.
Okay, cool. Touching more on this, as far as writing goes, and obviously you're a principal songwriter. How does that work? You know, how do you and Nick work together as a team, or Aaron, or any of those guys? You've been together for so many years. I just want to kind of know more of how the partnership works. Does it come naturally most of the time? Is it a struggle? Is it kind of like, you know, you do something and the other guy gets it? Or sometimes are you fighting for ideas? You know, I'm just kind of curious how it typically, you know, goes down for Paradise Lost, I guess.
Well, I mean, it started as a free-for-all in the early days. Like, if anyone had any riffs, throw them in. But it just transpired after a few years that it was pretty much me and Nick just doing all the stuff, because you know, people weren't into the same kind of music at the time, or maybe they just didn't share the same style of writing. And then over the years, it just became me and Nick. On the last record, on The Plague Within, we actually changed the songwriting a little bit, how we did it. It's always been me sending Nick a bit of music and then him putting some vocals over it. But usually it was done in a very structured way and very, I guess we were kind of precious about our parts. So I would send him pretty much a finished song and then he would put vocals over it. But on this record, I would send just a couple of bits of music to Nick. And I'd say, can you try out as many different vocal styles as possible over this one piece of music? And then he'd send it back and I would strip away the music and then almost build a song out like building blocks with the different vocal parts in different sections and see what worked. And chop them up and try it out and then send it back to Nick. And sometimes it'd freak him out hearing what he'd sang over a different piece of music.
Right.
But I think it made for a very intuitive and fast way of working. You know, you can try out many different styles in a shorter space of time and just see what works and what doesn't, you know.
Okay. Very interesting. Cool. Kind of getting away a little bit from the new record, because I'm sure you guys are getting, don't mind the pun, plagued with the same questions over and over again with the record.
That's the first time I've heard that. I'm quite amazed no one said that before.
Right.
Yeah,
it's that American wit.
Yeah, yeah.
So I kind of wanted to ask you some personal questions.
Okay.
At least for my own personal stuff that I've been wondering about. The whole Sisters of Mercy thing, I know you kind of had a stint with them, at least playing live and stuff. I'm a big fan, and I think a lot of the musical tastes that I've found that you've shared in the past, I've kind of had a lot of the same similar tastes. So with that band, you know, I guess we don't need to get into the whole story, but how did you enjoy the time playing with them live, and was it a good experience? Do you still get along? You still stay in contact, that kind of thing?
With Sisters, we had a great time on the tour. We didn't know what to expect because obviously I'd kind of grown up, well, a couple of us had grown up being into those records from a very early age, you know, like First, Last and Always and stuff like that, the very early, and Reptile House recordings. So I've been aware of them since like 82 or something like that, you know, 83. So it was kind of daunting going in, but then Andrew Eldritch was just so unassuming. I didn't even recognise him at first. I thought he was a local roadie or something, because he was just like kind of like bumbling around in all in this camo gear and stuff. And he more or less just wandered around, went shopping every day, went into... He was always in like thrift shops buying things, which sounds strange, but I'd kind of heard that about him, that he likes thrift shop buying. This is going back a while now. I'm not sure if he still does this, but...
Okay.
And the guys in the band were all really cool, but they've been kind of interchangeable since then, I think, you know.
Right.
I think the only guy that stayed there from when we toured with them was the guy who you don't see on stage, Dr. Avalanche. He's the guy who basically works the drum machine.
Gotcha.
And the samples. And he's a really cool guy. And no, we had a blast on that tour, and then we haven't seen them for a lot of years, but I know some of the members now as well. And then we played at Soundwave Festival in Australia a couple of years ago, which is a big touring festival, and the Sisters were on that as well, and we kind of caught up with them on that and hung out, and it was kind of nice to catch up, you know. Yeah, I think Andrew's a little bit of a speed freak casualty from the 80s, 70s and 80s, so he's a quirky guy.
Yeah.
But once you break down that veneer, he's pretty cool, you know.
Cool. Yeah, that was just interesting to me when I had seen you got that gig back in the day. I'd grown up the same way, obviously 10 years later than yourself, but my aunt, you know, is about your age, and she was taking me to Fetish Balls when I was 13, doing merch for them, and you know, we kind of got into all the goth rock and post punk early on when I was listening to metal, you know, so it all kind of merged together for me as well.
It seems strange that Sisters still pull the crowds, and they haven't actually recorded new material since 1990.
Right, it's crazy, right?
Yeah, pretty strange.
Yeah, good for them. Okay, so let's get to some more fun questions, I guess. You know what, I'll go back to one before we get to these. So, me being a drummer, I went to school for music in Los Angeles for percussion. Peter, who played on Faith Divides Us, Death Unites Us, I thought was one of the best drummers you had on a record. And I just kind of wanted to get your take on him, since kind of, you know, I feel like it's come and gone, and no one knows who he is and the whole thing, but... just kind of your relationship with him and how that came to be and how you feel about his performance on that record versus, I guess, other performances on other records. I would just be curious to know.
Well, I was talking to Aaron about this about a week ago because we did a couple of festivals. And, Peter Damin was... I mean, he was a session guy.
Right.
That we brought in. But oh my God, I could not believe what I was hearing when he was warming up and stuff. I mean, just this new level of, because I guess he session drums in every style. So he's like trying, and you could actually say to him, actually, could you fit in some kind of jazz fill in there? And he would just instantly do it,
That's awesome.
And instantly get it. And he had some interesting percussive cymbal elements and things like that as well, because I said, can you bring all the different types of cymbals that you have? But he was kind of an unassuming guy. I mean, he just, it was kind of clock in, clock out type thing. But, he had a young son, 6, 7 at the time, and used to bring him in and he'd watch him playing the drums. And I think he was kind of loving the fact that his dad was pulling off all this stuff, So, I mean, I think it was a different sphere of music that he's from.
Right.
He's sessioned on metal stuff. He's sessioned on jazz stuff. He's even sessioned on mainstream pop and dance stuff. I knew he drummed on the Dr. Alban records in the early 90s and things like that, So it's, he's just this extremely experienced drummer, So it's kind of interesting to work with someone like that.
Now, was it ever a situation that came up where you guys were going to offer him a spot, or you kind of knew going in this is all it's going to be, or maybe he wasn't even interested, or you guys weren't interested, or personalities didn't mix? Was there ever a situation that came up that you approached him to keep the gig, or it just didn't happen that way?
No, it was just weird timing. Jeff, our drummer who was going out, who left, he'd left before we even wrote the record. So we just spent the record writing and looking for a drummer at the same time. 2 weeks before we went in to record the record, we finally agreed on Adrian Erlandsson being the drummer. So he was actually in the band before we recorded Faith Divides Us, a couple of weeks before. But we'd already been doing the parts and rehearsing with Peter Damin to do the record. So we knew he wouldn't be in the band. We knew Adrian was going to be, but we didn't realise maybe the level of drumming that Peter Damin would set in the studio,
Right. Yeah, it's just funny, I mean, I've been listening to you guys forever, and just hearing the subtleties in that record from a drummer's perspective. I mean, he's really doing his job. He's laying it down. It's there's no showcasing or any fancy stuff necessarily, but there's a lot of subtle hidden things within that tickle me, when I listen to it. I'm just like, oh my, it just hits that spot that gives you chills as a musician, when I listen to that record.
That's interesting hearing from a drummer's perspective, because from my not being a drummer, I kind of think if the drums are doing their job correctly in every aspect, then they shouldn't really stand out too much to you.
Right.
It's when the drummer does something wrong that you hear something.
No, this is true. Stands out. No, that is very, very, very true. But for him, yeah, sometimes there's those drummers that, for lack of a better, I guess, way of explaining it, have their own voice, And I guess that's the goal of every musician, right, is to have their own voice, so that when you hear that guy play, like yourself, I could hear a Gregor solo or a Gregor lead part and go, oh, that's Gregor McIntosh. I know that sound. I think it's even harder with drummers because there's no melodic sense, right? There's not something that they can fall into. So I think it's maybe even a little harder for drummers to have a voice. But when I listen to a record, I could pick out, oh, that's Gene Hoagland or that's Dirk Verbeuren. You know those guys by their playing.
Plus they're drumming on every record that there is.
Well, that's true too.
It has to be them.
But stylistically, you can pick it out. And I think for any musician to say, or to say that any musician has their own voice, I think is the greatest compliment I can give. And you're one of those guys, So I think that's what everyone strives for.
It is absolutely. And have you seen the Ginger Baker documentary?
Yes, I just watched it like a couple months ago. Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah, but he speaks about that in a way. He says that there are very few musical drummers, in the world I mean, I know he's a bit of a dick, and he comes across as not very likable at all.
Right.
But it does have a bit of a point there, where the drum becomes its own musical instrument rather than just percussion.
Right.
He mentions that, and I thought that was an interesting point, that, you know, certain drummers, very few in the world have ever been able to do that, you know.
Right.
And I guess most of them came from a different era.
Right. Right, yeah, yeah, yeah. They learned to play with more feel maybe back then, just the way the music evolved, and now obviously it's become a different thing, and especially in metal, everything being programmed or quantized, you lose a lot. So to be able to, especially in the metal world, hear those guys be able to kind of pick those things out that, you know, oh, I know that's him because he, you know, that's his flavor or whatever, or that's his style, that's his voice, I think is a cool thing. And I've been fortunate that I'm good friends with Dirk, and he's been a huge influence on me and my playing, and now to call a friend, or call him a friend, is a very cool thing as well. So, okay. All right, so a little bit of the fun stuff. Talking about musical influence, I actually just read, I can't remember if it was Noisy or Vice or one of these magazines. They did a cool little piece on you about your influences and then put videos up. I don't know if you remember that recently, but you talked about Discharge and even Adamant and all these influences. Kind of you went through various different genres and the ones that had influenced you, you know, as a youth and whatnot. I thought that was a really cool article. So I kind of wanted to touch on a few that that I've been fans of that kind of want to pick your brain and see your thoughts. Just real quick, just a couple words, unless you feel like the need to expand or expound on them. But Depeche Mode.
Depeche Mode, I really, really loved quite a long time ago. At first, it wasn't cool to say you liked them because... in the very early synth pop days, you know, around the time of Yazoo and all that, you know, when and things like that, it was very uncool to like that stuff. And I was growing up in a punk scene, so you couldn't really talk about liking them.
Right.
You know, when Violator hit, I think it was okay to like some stuff. And when Songs of Faith and Devotion came out, they'd kind of start hanging around with Alice in Chains and stuff. So it was. It was perfectly okay to mention them then. So yeah, I mean, I can listen to pretty much any era of Depeche Mode, up to and including Ultra, and maybe just after that. I don't think there's been a lot of stuff since then that's kept my interest. It's all seemed a little bit repetitive and a little bit too soppy and reflective for me, you know?
Right.
But I don't know why that is. Maybe it's just a taste thing, but I think the kind of after Ultra, something of their edge went, you know?
No, I agree completely, and I'm a fan of the same albums, and I've tried some of the newer ones, and they don't all just, right, it's a kind of a lot of what you said. What about David Gahan's last solo record he did in 2007, Hourglass?
I actually thought there was some interesting stuff on that. And what was the one he did before that? Was it called Paper Monsters or something?
Is that what it was?
Maybe. I don't know, but...
You're right, Paper Monsters.
There was some interesting stuff on that. Again, maybe a little bit too soppy and reflective in parts, but at least there was a couple of tracks that had a bit of an edge to them, which it seems Depeche Mode haven't had since then, you know? So maybe it's Martin Gore that's got this... kind of more introspective edge these days, you know?
Right. And not to carry too far off, but I've always likened you guys to Depeche Mode, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, and not just because of the host era or anything like that. Obviously, I felt like there was a huge influence of that coming through at that time. But before that, even, just the songwriting, Depeche Mode's probably one of, to me, the best songwriters of all time. And,
I agree.
And you guys are similar in the metal realm. So
I used to like how their chord progressions went. They were very unexpected at times.
Right.
You know, they'd be going down a path and you'd think, you know what's coming next, and then it'd just shift into this note that you wondered where the hell it came from. And very clever songwriting, not just the usual songwriting style where you use the Bee Gees jump. halfway through a trap to make it spring out. You know, they do very interesting things, you know. So, yeah, I always admired songwriters way and above guitarists, which is maybe why I don't sound too much like a normal guitarist, I guess.
You know? Right.
It's probably because I was more listening to songwriting and string lines and stuff like that than I was guitar lines, you know.
Well, that makes sense, you know. And for them to do it in such a pop sensible way, or at least one that people could latch onto and still do their own thing, and like you said, make those chord changes that, you know, to us are kind of like, whoa, that they came out of left field, but still ring true to mass media and still catchy enough to grab hold of so many people, I think is quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, I think what a lot of people don't realize is how hard it is to do up tempo, upbeat songs.
Right.
That are very melancholic and bittersweet and kind of sad. It's hard to blend those two because it's like a dichotomy, you know.
Right, like the Smiths. Depeche
Mode managed to do it, you know. Yeah, like the Smiths, yeah, as well.
they really go on the extreme, and like you said, the music doesn't sound the way the vocal approach to the feel comes off sometimes, right?
That's right, yeah.
Skinny Puppy.
Skinny Puppy, I've never particularly been a fan. I wasn't massively into a lot of the industrial scene. Just little bits and pieces here and there. But it was mainly sounds that I was interested in from a production point of view.
Right.
You know, I'd hear things and I'd think, oh, wow, that sounds really, really cool. But overall, I found it a little bit annoying and up its own arse, the industrial scene. You know, everyone kind of was too cool for school at the time, and I found it too irritating to even get into it, you know.
Right. Like, so if you're not, you don't have any Throbbing Gristle records in the collection or anything?
I probably do, but it's probably because someone sent it to me or gave it to me.
Okay. All right. So what are some things, and I know this for me when I go certain places, but for you, what is a must-have for you when you come to the States, you know, or I guess for any country that you feel worth mentioning, you know, when you're like, all right, I'm going to Australia, or I'm going to the U.S., what do you get excited about, you know? Is it food? Is it something that you just have to have while you're here kind of thing?
Well, my wife's from Philly, and I spend at least maybe once a year I go to the States and hang out, sometimes a couple of times a year. And when we do tours as well, it sounds stupid, but it's always the stores, like the general stores. Like, I love going to Target. Target, just Walmart and Target. I love wandering around them and marveling at the hugeness of it and how many different things you can get in one store, you know. It sounds stupid, but when I see a Target, I just get all giddy. Also Best Buy as well. I love looking in Best Buy. And getting decent Mexican food, because it's hard to get decent Mexican food in the UK.
I can imagine.
So, you know, I love, as soon as I get to the States, I usually overkill on Mexican food for the first 2 or 3 days, and then I can't stand the sight of it for the rest of the time I'm there.
Okay, cool.
But other countries, it varies, you know. You mentioned Australia. In Australia, my main thing is I'm just have to try and find a bargain, because it's the most expensive country in the world at the minute.
Really?
And it has been for the last few years. It's the only country in the world, I think, that didn't happen, wasn't part of the crash, the economic crash.
Wow.
So their currency stayed really strong. And if you go to, like, the west coast of Australia, Perth, if you buy a coffee there, it's like the equivalent of maybe £6-7, so that'd be over $10 just for a coffee.
Wow, yeah, that's crazy. So even Norway, I mean, I know they're pretty pricey up that way too.
Yeah, Norway's up there, but I mean, last time I went to Australia a couple of years ago, I was truly horrified by how expensive it was.
All right, interesting. Excuse me if you don't partake in this, but with the explosion of, you know, craft beer and this whole thing kind of worldwide at this point, are you still drinking these days, or are you not? And I guess that would lead me to my next question of, you know, favorite beers that you of the moment, whether they be, you know, whatever part of the world.
Yeah, the craft beer thing is happening all over, but definitely more so in the States. I mean, I remember touring there in like 92, and there was only one place that I went to that had a kind of a craft beer bar, and that was Salt Lake City, believe it or not. And wow. it was truly appalling. I mean, like, the beers were horrible. So I kind of gave up on American beer for a lot of years, and then I started to like beers that you're not supposed to like Pabst Blue Ribbon and stuff. But now, yeah, the craft beers. I mean, when I was recording the Valenfire album in Salem, we were in a different pub every night in Salem, trying out every single beer, and they're all like microbreweries there and stuff. So you've got like, I don't know, 20 different beers to try every night.
Right.
And I found myself becoming a bit of a fan of the IPAs over there. Some of the IPAs were I wouldn't normally drink something like that because I'm more of a lager person in the UK. I either drink Guinness or I'll drink like a Belgian beer like Stella Artois or French beer like Kronenbourg or something.
Right.
You know, I like the odd German beer like Vorsteiner. But yeah, mostly lagers, but when I come to the States, I tend to drink IPAs, just because I think they've finally been able to create some decent beers.
No, that's for sure. That's for sure. It's taken some time and some Q&A issues. I think there's some quality things that needed to happen over time, you know. Yeah, it's definitely happened here, and IPAs are obviously enormous. I mean, it's too saturated. It's like, you know, worse than the death metal scene of the 90s or... I mean, it's overpopulated, oversaturated, so I'm wondering if and when the bubble will burst.
It's bound to burst because you've got these barmen or bar owners that stand and love talking about these beers in America.
Right.
And they're just so wanky. I mean, it's like they don't have any other word in their vocabulary apart from too hoppy.
Right. IPA, you know, hoppy, right.
Yeah, that's all they're saying. It's like, just let me drink it. I'll be the judge of that. You
know, so. I know you were a fan of reading in spare time and whatnot. So, are there any favorite authors? I guess all time or authors at the moment that you're digging, if you've had time to get into some books.
I've kind of shifted in my reading habits over the last few years. When back in the 90s, early 2000s, I used to read a lot of fiction. My favorite book, even though they've made horrific films of it since, my favorite book was I Am Legend, just because it was so utterly depressing. And it was written in the 50s. And there's been many film adaptations of it, or Mega Man with Charlton Heston,
right.
Last Day on Earth, Vincent Price, and the horrible Will Smith one. But the book itself is kind of completely different to all of those film adaptations. It's just really, really black through to the core. It's like The Road, the movie, you know, where there's just no light at the end of the tunnel.
Right.
And I used to like that in fiction. But these days I find myself, if I'm on the road, I'll read more practical books. I like, what was the last one I read? Bill Bryson book called Home. And it's just about the origins of things in the house and how the house came about and why you have bedrooms and why you have two stories and why forks have four prongs and why you have salt and pepper on the table instead of other spices, you know. And
right.
Just all these weird things. I'm kind of a fact junkie. I like a lot of facts, you know. So, you know, me and Steve, the bass player in... Paradise Lost, kind of try to out-fact each other a lot. My speciality is animal facts.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, give me one exciting animal fact that maybe not many people will know.
Most of mine center around the blue whale, because I'm obsessed with blue whales, so I can give you hundreds about the blue whale, but one that no one believes me about is about a hippo, and it's that hippo's milk is pink.
Really?
It's that simple. And a lot of people go, yeah, right. And it's like, look, I'm not going to go milk a hippo to prove it, but just look it up. It's true, you know.
Interesting.
But blue whale ones are like 10 a penny. Like an adult can swim through the main arteries of a blue whale without touching the sides and stuff. So,
wow.
You know, it's a pretty big thing.
Yeah, that's pretty intense. No, it's interesting that you say that too, and I find myself getting older, reading more nonfiction and reality-based things, and kind of still hunting, I guess, for knowledge. I guess maybe because we're not in school anymore and we don't need that escape. Now we're looking for ways to learn, you know, subconsciously still. I don't know.
Yeah, I think I did it backwards. I mean, a lot of people get more spiritual as they get older. I think when I was a kid, I was all into, you know, all this dark side of life and trying to be all freaky goth type thing and stuff. And as I've got older, I'm kind of looking for factual things and have no interest in spiritual things at all because I don't believe in any of it, you know. And I think a lot of people do that back to front.
No, yeah, I agree. And I think, well, maybe it's from kind of where we come from in the metal world or kind of this, you know, I was kind of similar, and I'm sure a lot of people were coming from where we came from, but, yeah, kind of exploring that whole thing when you're younger, and then, you know, we come this path later, but it's interesting to look into that. Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time. We've kind of been going for a while here, but I appreciate you taking the time.
Anyway, nice talking to you, Thomas.
You as well. Hopefully we'll meet again one of these days. And if you're back in the States, hopefully I can catch up with you guys and hang out for a bit and have a pint.
Yeah, cheers, man. Yeah. All right. Okay, thank you.
Cheers, Greg. Good luck to you.
Bye-bye.